You are all so articulate and so generous. And this is a fantasy moment for me to have all of you here, first of all, is so unbelievably wonderful, and I have no abilities to be articulate. Anyway, luckily, it's incredibly late. So the reception started 5 minutes ago, so I'm not going to be able to give my remarks and my thanks. Perhaps I can at dinner later. But I will give a few in terms of thanks. Of course, I want to thank Tim and Jen for organizing this experience, which it was always my dream to have a fascist reunion, but I never imagined it as something this powerful and remarkable. I want to thank all the panelists who came and shared not just memories, but their work and their thinking and their insights, which are powerful, and which is why it amused me when someone first said there was a Judson Mafia. That was already 10 years ago, I think. And I thought, right, that's funny, because it gives me credit for the thinking of all of these remarkable people who are here today. And what really matters to me is my relationship to each of you. And for that, I'm really grateful. I also want to quickly point out, there's several people, former fascists, in the audience who are historians and who weren't on the panel, and I'm very grateful that all of you came, some from very long distances. And then I also want to mention a couple of people who couldn't be here, but I need to mention them. Most of you will remember Terry Brown, who now lives in Texas, and I just have to mention her name because she went without her, I certainly couldn't have been a chair. And then I want to mention three colleagues, also former fascists, who couldn't be here but wanted to, and that's Caitlin Murdoch, Brendan Karch, and Helene Blumenthal. Just, there are many others too. Those are the ones I'm going to mention. So I'd want to thank all of you. I have plenty of opinions, as all of you know, about all of the issues and all of the questions that were raised. I have lots of answers. I think mine are right. I'm not quite that queer. But there's no time for any of that. I also had some opinions about big history, no time for that, popularization, and to try to explain how through my new book I'm trying to take on a lot of the issues that you guys raised today, but no time. I was gonna say a few words about what my new life at the EUI is like.
You have time for a few things.
All right. And there is something I have to say before I say anything about anything else, which is I do think it's really wonderful, but also interesting and important, that no one went into fascism as a field. That fascism was the thing that brought us all together, but as that we all, I think in every seminar going back to 1994 or 93, we all ended up agreeing that as a field, it's over. It doesn't. Fascism is not fascism. It's the political, cultural, social phenomena that is going on in all of these societies and many elements going on today. And that's more important than particular regimes. I'm now a professor at the European University Institute, which is a remarkable place. It's a place where I live nation and empire in daily life. It's a place that's made me come to understand that the distinction between nation and empire, which has been at the heart of a lot of my work, is in fact, I no longer buy as a distinction. I teach a seminar with a colleague, Lucy Ryle, who's an Irish woman who teaches Italian history, brilliant. And we teach the seminar called Nations and Empires in Modern Europe, and we both decided this year, nations are gone, it's just empires. There are no nations, there are just empires. The practices of empire, the many of which were brought up by many of you, are all the practices of the people and states that call themselves nations. So anyway, the other interesting thing about the EUI is we are there to forge a common academic community out of people who come from remarkably different academic worlds. And we have to find a way to talk to each other. We use the English language, which makes me feel guilty a lot, but we do. But I noticed this immediately, that all of our students, who are all PhD students, come from such radically different traditions and cultures that mostly what we're doing in the first 2 years especially is learning how to talk to each other and actually communicate. And there's much more to that than I realized or ever thought there would be. I'm advising amazing students who remind me of my Swarthmore students, except it's the opposite of what Tara pointed out. It's true, every year, in this year included, I was always sorry that you would graduate and I wouldn't get to work with you later. But now I'm getting all these people I didn't get to work with when they were 18. So I have to kind of, right. But I'm advising all kinds of amazing topics from one of my Irish students who's writing a history, sort of a social cultural history of the gay rights movement in Ireland in the 70s and 80s, to a brilliant Ukrainian student who's writing a history of migrant female labor in the 1940s and 1950s. I have a Finnish student who's writing a history of single men and the idea of domesticity in the 19th century in Finland. It's an amazing range, and I also feel privileged to be working with them. But I couldn't be working with them if I hadn't have been working with you first. Okay. It is my belief that in my field, a field I share with many of you, that as Tara pointed out, we've had a lot of brilliant studies in the last 20 years. But for some reason, and this gets to points many of you raised, they have made no impact at all on the popular narratives of the parts of the world we write about, particularly Central and Eastern Europe. And this was proven once again last year with the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of World War I, and every single cliche you could ever imagine about the Habsburg monarchy was trotted out again, and everyone still believes them. So I am trying to see my work as an intervention in terms of creating a narrative that will be able to encompass all of this amazing work that's been done in the last 20 years, including works by many of you, while being mindful that I don't think we need to have a single narrative, but we do need narrative, and we do need to communicate through narrative. And I think that as many of you pointed out, incredibly necessary to deconstruct the canon. And I don't want a new canon, but I do want stories that people can tell. And I want them to be persuasive, and I want them to be compelling. And I feel that the only way to work at the moment is by bringing together the absolute local, the way Seth did, for example, in The Match Girl and The Heiress, this compelling, unbelievable relationship between two people from vastly different backgrounds, which Seth stitched together from archives he shared a part of it, but using his historical skills tells this amazingly important story that on one level is about the British Empire and in another level is about the difficult and compelling relationship between two human beings. And I think the way of telling the story of Habsburg Central Europe has to involve the kind of tacking back and forth between those levels. I'm trying to, in my book, which was supposed to be called Our Empire, except the press doesn't like that name, and to sell, it's going to have to be called The Habsburg Empire, which is I can't begin to explain how stupid that is. But in any case, Our Empire, the idea was to show how to tell the story of Central and Eastern Europe through questions of commonality, common practices, common engagement with institutions which were common throughout Central and Eastern Europe, rather than starting to tell a story by using the conceptual apparatus of different nations. And we've, I think, had enough nation talk for one day anyway. I'm trying very hard not simply to provincialize Europe, but to make Eastern Europe a part of Europe. I'm trying to work very hard to find a compelling narrative that will not pathologize diversity, because that is the story about Central and Eastern Europe. Diversity is a terrible thing because it produces bloodshed. And it's difficult to tell that story in a different and new way. I'm talking about state building, but state building from below, the way in which common people in villages and towns engage with states for their purposes. And I'm trying to think of this in global terms as well. And I think part of the book that Tara and I hope to write about the First World War in this part of the world is about thinking about what it meant in China or India, in the way Aris Manella sort of gets at. When the Habsburg monarchy falls, it's the first empire that falls. And how does that then achieve a global resonance that lives on very importantly in the 20s in terms of how people talk about what empire should all empires fall and what should replace them and what should our relationships be. Okay, that's what I'm working on. And it has to be done by July 1st, and I'm still writing the World War I chapter, so. But I just want to say that what's so compelling to me is what all of you are working on, and the work that you shared with us today, and from which I have learned so much, and many of you who don't even know it will be in the footnotes one way or another, and I agree with Seth, that's how we can validate collaboration at the moment, because we don't have many models for that, and interdisciplinarity isn't even possible, although everyone touts it. So I want to thank all of you, and I want to thank you so much for this opportunity for me to connect to the many years that I had here, to my very dear colleagues who taught me so much. When that Guardians of the Nation was still a project, the history department ripped me to shreds in the nicest way when I presented part of it to them and made me go back and rethink it in really important ways. I so appreciated the collegiality, and if we were all laughing in fascist Europe, I'll end with that. Thank you so much.